Leaning Toward Wisdom, episode 4055. Welcome inside the Yellow Studio. My name is Randy Kentrow, your host here at Leaning Toward Wisdom. This is episode 4055. Why I covered this paperback book when I was in high school. There's a photograph of it. You can go to the website and check it out. LeaningTowardWisdom.com. Just plug in the number 4055 and you'll see me holding a book. It doesn't look like a book, but trust me, it's a book. What was so bad about this book that I had to cover it with, well, what now appears to be plain paper? We'll do it next. He is Rod Argent, the name of the group, Argent, a 1972 record. The record was All Together Now. Rob Argent was a UK guy, sang with a band called The Zombies. This song was a song that, like so many others of my youth, I just completely wore it out. Hold Your Head Up. Great song. It was a great record. I owned it as an album, and I owned it as an 8-track. That was the bad thing. When 8-tracks came around, we had to put music in our cars. Yeah, I mean, if you were like me and you had a stereo system, you had to duplicate your entire library. Many of us found ourselves doing the same thing when CDs came around, by the way. But that's the record, Argent, Hold Your Head Up. You should hold your head up. You should buy that record, by the way. If you are into classic rock, and my lands, if you're not, you definitely should be. All the music, by the way, I have purchased. I have supported these artists, and I would encourage you to do the same thing. Why I covered this paperback book when I was in high school. Now, by now, maybe you've checked out the website and you've seen the photograph. It's a large photograph, and I purposefully left it as a large photograph so that you could see it. New Year's Day, 1974. That is when Bantam Books published this book. Can't be sure when I bought it, but I am certain that it was in 1974. And I'm rather certain that I bought it shortly after it came out because that's the kind of guy I was. And it was, by the way, the year that I still maintain was one of the best years for music. If you go back and you listen to episode 4018, I did a show called You'll Never Forget the Music of Your Youth. And I talked about the music of my youth, music of 1974. If you look at the photograph of this book that I have covered the published cover of this book with what appears to be plain paper. But no, look at it closely now. Go to the website, check it out, leaningtowardwisdom.com. That plain paper, it wasn't always plain paper. It was once notebook paper. It once had those blue aqua lines on it. Look closely at the photograph, and you will see the red margin line. And you will see very closely at the bottom of it, you'll see holes punched in that paper. It's at least 40 years old. Well, the paper, and well, the book that's under it is also that old. And it has not been uncovered since I covered it. And when I covered it right after I got it. I covered it because I'd often read it at school. And sometimes, yes, I admit it, sometimes I would read it in class. It's a thick paperback, by the way. It has 783 pages. And it does have some photographs, quite a few photographs. Back when they would put photographs in the center of the paperback. Are you old enough to remember those days? Do they still do that? I don't know that they still do that. I think they just kind of put photographs throughout the book. But there was a time where all the photographs just, I don't know why they, I'm sure they did this because it was, the photographs were done on different paper. And to insert them in a section by themselves, I'm sure just in the manufacturing process, it was easier. And so this one's got quite a few photographs in the middle of it as well. I would carry this book to class. I remember carrying it to class that entire year, 1974, and I'm sure I read from it daily. Now, here's the odd thing to me. Nobody ever asked, hey, what are you reading? And as an adult now, I'm thinking, you know, a book that is covered, well, my lands, a book that's covered should garner far more attention than the cover itself. I mean, wouldn't you think? When it's a homemade cover like this. Now, this was before we had those cloth covers and vinyl covers that you see sometimes people, book protectors, you know, back then. And I did this. I've looked through a number of my books. I've got books that are covered in brown paper bags, you know, where I would cut them to fit the cover of the book, and even sometimes masking tape on the inside. I think this one's held together with Scotch tape. You would think that it would almost make it more obvious and make people more inquisitive. But no, not so much. Turns out I must have known something because nobody ever questioned me. Not even teachers. Mission accomplished. For me, the objective was to read it in anonymity. Not my own, but anonymity for the book. The writers of the book, names like Ben Fong Torres, Yan Winner, Cameron Crowe, Hunter S. Thompson, Dave Marsh, many, many others. The music, Bob Dylan, Joni Mitchell, Buffalo Springfield, Led Zeppelin, The Rolling Stones, Creedence Clearwater Revival. Since 1970, I had nearly worn out my copy of Creedence Clearwater Revival's Cosmos Factory. And it was, man, it was just such a terrific record. And it had classic songs on it. If you're into classic rock and roll, you know these songs. Before You Accuse Me, Looking Out My Back Door, Run Through the Jungle, Who'll Stop the Rain? I Heard It Through the Grapevine. But it also contained this incredibly classic song. It was in the pages of Rolling Stone that I learned that this record, a record I loved, by the way, I remember studying this album cover, man, for hours. It was in Rolling Stone that I learned that this record had been produced by one of my favorite bands, Creedence Clearwater Revival. And it was done in the midst of bickering, lots and lots of bickering and fighting. And I remember being so discouraged reading that, because I'm like, how can a group of guys that can make such terrific music not get along, especially when two of them are brothers? Yeah, such was the case. John Fogerty, he was alienating the rest of the band, including brother Tom. And I remember being sad reading about that, because I thought, you know, this is not going to end well. How can guys that make this kind of music be headed for a breakup? And it was the first time. It was the first time that I ever felt like knowing too much about the people who created the music. It sort of hurt the mystery behind the music. It didn't matter. I still read. It was 1970, and John Fogerty and the rest of the boys, they could still see the light, a little bit of it. Cosmos Factory, Long As I Can See the Light, one of my all-time favorite records. And again, read about it in Rolling Stone. I read Rolling Stone and Melody Maker, which was a UK music tabloid. I read those with great regularity. And during the Vietnam War, Rolling Stone was filled with political articles as well as music stuff. I was there mostly for the music, but I did read the political stuff, especially during the Vietnam War, mainly because mostly I found Hunter S. Thompson. And Hunter S. Thompson had this ongoing feud with the Nixon White House that, even for an apolitical guy like me, I found it pretty entertaining. I don't really remember the first time I read Hunter, but it was likely in Rolling Stone. It might have been when I picked up a copy of the paperback book Hell's Angels, The Strange and Terrible Saga of the Outlaw Motorcycle Gangs. It was sometime, though, around 1972, a couple of years before this book came out, that I decided I would cover up. It was around 1972 when I first read Hunter, because I was beginning to drive. And in Louisiana, where I lived at the time, you could get your full-blown driver's license at 15. Now, Thompson, he fascinated me mainly, though, because of his first-person journalism. He would later call it gonzo journalism. I wasn't into drugs. I wasn't into alcohol. In fact, to this day, I've never tried either. But it was the 1970s, and everybody I knew smoked grass. Okay, today's hip term is weed. Quaaludes and other pills, those were popular during my high school days as well. Smoking, swallowing, and snorting, those were the three S's of drug consumption in my high school days. The fourth S, shooting, not so pervasive. I mean, the kids of my high school, they just weren't fond of needles. Even the druggies weren't fond of needles. But Hunter S. Thompson was very entertaining. I thought he was ridiculously clever. In fact, today, just last night, I picked up one of the books, and he was writing about electricity. I mean, the guy can write about anything. Well, he could write about anything, and just clever, very clever. And I can read and I can laugh out loud. In fact, I did. I was laying in bed last night and reading it, and Rhonda was over there doing some sewing and stuff, some handwork. And I'm over here reading some little 1.5-page ditty that he wrote back in the 80s on electricity, and I just found it comical. Yeah, he was weird. But as he was fond of saying, when the going gets weird, the weird turn pro. And he was a pro. Well, he was especially a pro at being weird. And in the early 70s, I anxiously waited to see if the current issue of Rolling Stone had anything written by him. I mean, that's how anxious I was. And occasionally he would write, he would incorporate rock stars and stuff of the era. But, you know, he mostly just always had this axe to grind. And I was quite happy to watch him grind it. Had it not been for Vietnam and later on Watergate, my interest in national politics would have been non-existent. But I had never picked up Rolling Stone for political news. I was there for the music. I was there for the interviews with musicians. I was there for the talk with producers and record executives. The reviews of the latest records. You know, those were all the things that I gobbled up in every issue. And during these years, there were a few songs that stood out because, well, music was heavily listened to in our cars now, thanks to 8-track tapes. In 1972, every teenager's music collection included Deep Purple's Machine Head. I mean, man alive, we must have played this song at least a handful of times every single time we got in the car. Deep Purple, 1972. The album was Machine Head. Everybody I knew had a copy of this. And everybody I knew had it on 8-track at least. And some of us had it, well, some of us had it on vinyl as well. Machine Head, Smoke on the Water. You know, a lot of the music holds up. Yeah, I don't know that this holds up that much. I admit it's been a long time since I've listened to any Deep Purple, but man, we listened to it a lot, though, when I was 15, 16 years old. Rolling Stone and Melody Maker. They were always filled with news of the major names in the music business. In fact, chief among the supergroups of the era was Led Zeppelin. Nobody was bigger than Zeppelin. And not if you were a teenager in the 1970s. Now, the Rolling Stones, they may have held that title back in the 70s, and or the 60s, I should say. And, yeah, they were big in the 70s and even still big in the 80s. But, yeah, nah, they couldn't fly higher than the Zeppelin. And not among the crowd I ran with. The Who, yeah, okay, they were getting there. But I remember mostly being intrigued with Pete Townsend's, you know, destruction of guitars and, well, and Keith Moon, I mean. But, you know, hey, Led Zeppelin, they had their own drummer. They had their own crazy man, John Bonham. Keith Moon was nuts, but Bonham was, he was just a mad dog, crazed, beat the snot out of the drums kind of a guy. And Robert Plant, well, has there ever been a better or a more ideal rock and roll voice. And Jimmy Page, well, Jimmy Page was annually voted among readers of Rolling Stone and other such magazines as the greatest guitarist around. John Paul Jones, I mean, come on, the keyboardist and the bassist. I mean, come on, with a name like that, even American teenagers knew that he was a rock and roll star, John Paul Jones, and he was from the UK. Now, in my circles, nobody knew the bass player in a band except me. Well, and maybe other guys in high school, guys that played bass, but, man, there was just, these were for us. These absolutely were for us. Dancing Days. Led Zeppelin, 1973, Houses of the Holy. This album got played every day. This tape in our cars got played every single day. No question. It got played on the way to school. It got played on the way home from school. It got played when we were out cruising around. Dancing Days. Not only did I not smoke, not only did I not drink, I didn't dance either. Still don't. But, you know, metaphorically, they were dancing days, man. Cameron Crowe's name in Rolling Stone, that name was often the byline of the stuff that I really love to read. And I remember I was shocked when I found out that he was my age, 16. My age, and he's talking with this guy. He's talking with Jimmy Page. He's on tour with these guys. He's having his photograph taken, and with just about every other major rock star of the day. How was a kid doing this, I wondered. And Crow, he was a bigger mystery to me than the stars that he was writing about when I was a senior in high school. Years later, he'd win some awards for his movie. Very autobiographical, called Almost Famous. The worldly heroes of my youth were musicians and writers. And these guys weren't business people. Yeah, okay, Mr. Winter was, he was the guy that started Rolling Stone, but I didn't think of him as a business guy. I mean, come on, he was a writer. Music and words. Those were the two things that mattered, as far back as I can remember. Two areas of human pursuit that smote me the most, and quite often still do. The book that I decided to get a piece of, actually, I think it's two pieces of notebook paper and wrap around the cover of this book. The book, The Rolling Stone Rock and Roll Reader. Circa 1974. I'm not sure why I covered it, except I wanted it to be an anonymous read. I didn't want the jellyheads to see it. They were the guys who smoked and snorted and swallowed anything to get high. Later on, we'd call them stoners, but in the early days, I remember us calling them jellyheads because that properly described their brain power. Well, they didn't have any brain power. I mean, they were quite a few rungs lower than a dimwit. And you really had to be low down on the totem pole to be a dimwit. But boy, they were lower than a dimwit. High school classes were more entertaining when these people were present. Well, if they were awake. And fortunately, I grew up amongst some students. I say this as though it was a bad thing. I don't know if it was a good thing or not. From the fourth grade on, I was put in classes with other people that had some brain power. Now, there was not, you know, today there's this AP. I don't even know what AP stands for. There's these accelerated things. They didn't really have that. But in fourth grade, I got thrown into some kind of a pilot program, much to the chagrin of my parents. And I remember it being quite frustrating because I knew other kids who they could score substantially lower than me and make a higher grade. That didn't seem right, but I digress. If you could be in a class, though, that had some of these guys in it, it could be entertaining. I mean, especially if the teacher happened to call on them, you know. Well, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, that was done by Cameron Crowe. And that was very, very close to realistic, by the way. Jeff Spicoli, he was a jellyhead. I mean, if you were in high school in the early 70s, you knew a Jeff Spicoli. Okay, that may not have been his name, but you knew somebody like that. And if you didn't know somebody like that, then, well, welcome to the world. You are Jeff Spicoli. My family moved in the middle of my junior year in high school. I went from Southwood High School in Shreveport, Louisiana, to Broadmoor High School in Baton Rouge. The class of 75. Well, the class of 75 wouldn't be forced to wait on me because at the end of the fall semester in December of 1974, I closed out the year by marching into the principal's office and saying, I'm here for my diploma. And I was done with high school. By January 1975, I was riding my 10-speed around the campus of LSU as a college student. Very clueless, I might add, about what my life would be like. But I was still reading sections of this book with the cover still in place. The book was a collection of articles. In fact, it is a collection of articles that first appeared in the pages of Rolling Stone. Articles about bands that I cared nothing about, like The Doors. And Jim Morrison was an idiot, and I had no use for him or for them. Still don't. Lots of harsh feelings soften over time. My disdain for The Doors' music, not so much, has not softened over time. In fact, I would say that my intense hatred of The Doors is hotter than ever. Too strong? Okay, well, build a bridge. Get over it. It's my podcast. There were articles about bands and musicians who were very important, though, in my musical collections. Joni Mitchell, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Led Zeppelin, Eric Clapton. Edgar Winter, Frankenstein, Steely Dan, Little Feat, Jackson Brown, ZZ Top. The book includes articles written in the early days of Rolling Stone, long before it was on my radar back in the 60s. The magazine started in 1967, and it was around 1972, really, before I had started reading it with any regularity. My passion for listening to music, okay, it was hitting top gear. It was hitting top gear by 1972. And it wouldn't be long before I would walk into a stereo shop and I would get a job selling hi-fi gear. I still remember the smell of sound rooms. Don't ask me what the smell was, but, you know, you could just the smell of electronics. Well, and red shag carpet. Red shag carpet. Speakers on one wall, racks of gear on the other with all the dials and the lights illuminated. Comfortable chairs strategically placed near the middle of the room, you know, obviously facing the speakers. Amplifiers and preamps and turntables and open reel decks. Okay, well, otherwise known to you mere mortals as reel-to-reel decks. Few cassette decks, not many, though. I brought my musical taste with me to the stereo shop. But I quickly got creative. You know, because it wasn't about the music that I loved. It wasn't about the gear that I loved. It was about what the shoppers wanted. It was, well, I wanted customers. I wanted paying customers because, well, I was paid straight commission. If I didn't sell anything, I didn't make anything. In order to sustain my music habits, I needed paying customers. And in order to convert shoppers into buyers, I knew that the music had to be all about their experience, not mine. And besides, it was fun watching people get excited about a variety of music. Rolling Stone, Melody Maker, and this rock and roll reader helped me talk intelligently about the music, including the people who made it. I was a lot more than some techie guy with a working knowledge of the latest gear working at a hi-fi shop. I loved all that stuff, but it was, you know, it was, after all, it was just a means to an end to listen to great music, to be moved by the music that we loved and the stories that we had connected with it. The summer before this reader was published, a band emerged out of Jacksonville, Florida. No, it wasn't Tom Petty. He'd come on the scene later. The famous producer, and I remember buying records because his name was on the jacket. Al Cooper. Not Alice Cooper. Al Cooper with a K. Famous producer, and I had discovered this Southern rock and roll group that his name appeared on the jacket cover, and they had taken evidently the name of their high school gym teacher, Leonard Skinnerd. Well, they hit big time about the time school started back in August of 1973 with their album, pronounced Leonard Skinnerd. And for some reason, I remember them. I mostly remember them when I think about the times that I sat in class in school reading this undercover paperback book, The Rock and Roll Reader by Rolling Stone. Now, the Allman Brothers had invented Southern rock. And it wasn't just the Muscle Shoals, Alabama sound that was coming out of Muscle Shoals Sound Studio, which I first learned about, by the way, in the pages of Rolling Stone. It was having two lead guitars and two drummers. Who does this? Well, welcome to Southern rock and roll. You know, Southern rock and roll, it was a point of view. It was a frame of mind. And being from the South, yeah, okay, I could relate. I had friends that were from more northern climes, and they might not have been able to relate as much, but they certainly got the music. They understood the music. I mean, come on. How can you argue with this song? 1973. Lynyrd Skynyrd from the album Pronounced Lynyrd Skynyrd, Freebird. It's kind of become a little bit of a rock and roll something or other, you know, people hollering out at concerts, you know, Freebird. This was a big record though. August 1973, the Rolling Stone Rock and Roll Reader was released New Year's Day, 1974. And all of the writing about music, it influenced me. It helped me feel like I knew these people. I knew these people better who were creating this music that was in my ears every single day. This music that, well, it meant something to me. And whether any single article or review fully revealed the truth about these people, I was rather certain that it didn't. But that didn't matter to me. It really didn't matter to me. Because my consumption was so broad that I felt like, you know, when you read every article that comes out about, well, Lynyrd Skynyrd or anybody else, and even if you've got a cynical streak like I do, then you're able to distill enough truths about them to create kind of a fair version of who they might really be. Sometimes notions were confirmed. Sometimes notions were dashed. I, for some reason, I'm thinking of Jimi Hendrix. I owned some Jimi Hendrix records, but for me, he was a, you know, he was kind of a once in a while listen. Jimi Hendrix was never for me an everyday kind of a thing. In fact, I could go months without listening to anything he had ever done. And I knew he was into drugs, but, you know, so many of them were, most of them. There was just still something about him that just didn't ring for me, though. You know, that mythical thing. And it seemed to be a mythical thing that he really fostered and facilitated. I tell you who strikes me that way today, and he's not a musician. Well, he is a musician, but he's more of an actor. Johnny Depp. And I enjoy his acting. But, you know, watching him in interviews or reading an interview with him, it reminds me of that smoke-filled brain that I sensed in Jimi Hendrix. I've always been put off by such eclectic personalities as that, though. Now, that seems weird, doesn't it? In fact, a little too weird. And that's saying something, because I've already told you I was really fond of Hunter S. Thompson. Played by Johnny Depp, by the way, in the movie Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. I much prefer Bill Murray's version of Hunter, though, in Where the Buffalo Roam. You know, because Murray, you know, Murray, he's quirky, but I like him. Depp, he just seems to try too hard to be cerebral and mystical, mysterious. And Hendrix, he struck me the same way. And frankly, in all honesty, I thought Billy Gibbons and Robin Trower, they were more capable guitarists in my book. Not like I was an expert at guitarists, but as far as my listening preference, give me those guys all day long. In 1974, I was listening to three harder rock records than many more of the others. There was a little band out of Texas. They had released a bright green album cover in 1973. Tres Hombres. Now, this is rock and roll, and we indeed did like it. And we didn't play it and put it away. No. We played it, and then we played it some more. And you know what? It's only been 42 years, but the record still stands up today.
Rumors spreading around in that Texas town about the shack outside the games. And you know what I'm talking about. Just let me know if you wanna go to that home out on the range. They got a lot of nice girls. I'm racing. How? 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 How?
We loved them because there were only three of them, and we loved them because it was just straight ahead, straightforward. And this is what it is. No pretense. And I was a fan of the old blues guys like John Lee Hooker. In fact, there's a great record. It was one of my favorite records for a long time. John Lee Hooker with Canned Heat. And you talk about an eclectic record. So when I start hearing how, which I had heard old guys do all my life, by the way. You know, it's what old men did when they're trying to correct the kids that are running around a little too wild. How? Stop that. Well, I'd heard that all my life. So, man, alive, you're hearing a guy do it in a microphone? Part of a rock and roll band? That's pretty cool now. I mean, these ZZ Top guys, they had it going on. And I admit, I was a big, big fan. Still am a big fan of this record. I was a big fan until they kind of got so cheesy, you know. I mean, the bits just seemed to take over the music, you know, the beards and the fuzzy guitars. Okay, guys got to make a living. But I bought my last ZZ Top record in 1979 when Digueo was released. But boy, they were awesome back in the day. Don't tell me this record doesn't hold up. Give me Billy Gibbons all day long over Jimi Hendrix. I stand by it. The other record was released in 1974, and I was quite interested in this guy who had once played for Procol Harum. How did I know that? Rolling Stone. Now, Procol was a band of the 60s, and I admit that they were not on my radar, but Robin Trower. Yeah, buddy, Robin Trower, he sure was on my radar. Here's my question. Which came first, driving fast or listening to Robin Trower's Bridge of Sighs? By the way, trick question, because I can't do either of them without the other. '74, Robin Trower, Bridge of Sighs. The song is Day of the Eagle. I can tell you right now, I bought multiple copies of this vinyl. Why? Because I know I wore out one. Yeah, man, alive. Give me a car that'll go fast, that sits low on the ground, and a windy road, and turn this up. I'm good to go. And like ZZ Top's Trey Ombre, this holds up too. I will listen to this record I admit, I will listen to this record in the car driving more than I do ZZ Top's Trey Hombre. And I listen to it quite a bit. But I said there were three, and I didn't lie to you. There were three, because the trilogy of harder rock records for me during these Rolling Stone rock and roll reader days, it happened to be another record that would kind of make your foot go down further on the gas pedal. And it was Lou Reed's Rock and Roll Animal. And the record opens with a Stephen Hunter guitar lick that is still among the most notable guitar riffs in rock and roll history. Okay, Lynyrd Skynyrd's Free Bird. It might have been a few minutes longer. What was Free Bird? 10 minutes long, something like that. This song was 8-9 minutes. If somebody could just show me how to play what Stephen Hunter could play there, the opening licks of this song, the introduction to Sweet Jane, I'd be good to go. Be good to go. How did I know it was Stephen Hunter's guitar riffs? Because I knew he had played with Alice Cooper on that record that every teenager owned, Billion Dollar Babies. And other than the liner notes on the record, I knew that Stephen Hunter and Dick Wagner, also another Alice Cooper alumnus, I know they both played on this record with Lou Reed. See, you just can't know that stuff by listening to records. I mean, how you gonna know who that is playing that guitar riff if you don't do a little bit of reading, if you don't have a little bit of musical education? So musical education involves knowing who these people are and as much about them as you can. Well, in 1974, it did for me. And so I kept that book covered, my reading private, and my conversations filled with enough rock and roll knowledge to dazzle even the most skeptical of my friends. Trunks of Memories still to come. In 1974, had them. Had Trunks of Memories still to come. Drove cars that had a lot of chrome, weighed a whole lot, had a lot of horsepower, sucked a lot of gas. This was a great record. Stephen Stills and Neil Young in 1976, a couple of years after the Rock and Roll Reader was published. They produced a record called Long May You Run, and this was the title track. I have sung at the top of my lungs this song, along with Stephen and Neil. Wait, we could have been a trio. And you want to know what's crazy? I'll tell you what's crazy is how much of this stuff I can still retain in my puny brain today. Probably because, unlike the folks that I was reading about, I never took drugs and I never drank alcohol. I mean, somebody's got to remember this stuff, right? Site is leaningtowardwisdom.com. This has been episode 4055. Plug in that number over at the website and it'll take you straight to the show notes where the photographs and other links are. I hope you'll subscribe to the podcast. More importantly, I hope you'll tell a friend. My name is Randy Cantrell, coming to you from Dallas, Fort Worth, Texas, inside the Yellow Studio. In the sun. In 1972, there was a band. They had been introduced to us a year earlier in 1971. And in 1971, we had ridden a horse with no name until he couldn't be rode no more. They were, oddly enough, they were called America. But they all had something in common. These three guys, not only having great harmony, but these three guys from the UK, well, their dads were American. Yeah, but not their moms. Their moms were British. How did I know that? I knew that because I read Rolling Stone. And so they connected, they hooked up, started singing great harmony. And in 1971, they released that great record that I'm sure made them wealthy from now on. But in 1972, they came out with a record called Homecoming. And the hit, the big hit off of Homecoming by the group America was this song. And as with all of this music, Argent, Deep Purple, Lynyrd Skynyrd, Led Zeppelin, Creedence Clearwater, ZZ Top, Robin Trower, Lou Reed, Stephen Stills, Neil Young, buy this stuff, support these people. You do realize that if we didn't buy their stuff, how could they keep doing it? They can't. They can't work for free. So support them. Buy their music. And if not their music, buy the music of the people that you do like. But in the meanwhile, I'm going to take you out with this hit from America called Ventura Highway. Enjoy.
Chewing on a piece of grass, walking down the road. Tell me how long you gonna stay here, Joe. Some people say this town don't look good in snow. You don't care, I know. Ventura Highway in the sunshine, where the days are longer, the nights.
lights are stronger than moonshine. You're gonna go, I know. Surround your daylight there. Seasons crying, no despair. Alligator lizards in the air. In the air.
Wishing on a falling star. Waiting for the early train. Sorry, boy, but I've been hit by a purple rain. Aw, come on, Joe. You can always change your name. Thanks a lot, son, just the same.
Venture a highway.